Freedom News Hour with Walt Thiessen, Jake Town, and Gene DiNardo. Thursdays at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Don't you know, we're talking about a revolution sounds.
It's the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. I'm your host, Walt Thiessen, here with co-host Jake Town. Gene DiNardo is off this week, but hopefully he'll be back with us next week. And here are some of the headlines we're following on this Thursday, February 9, 2012. First, the federal government have announced, or are about to announce, actually, a $25 billion foreclosure abuse deal. That's a deal that the Obama administration has been pursuing for quite some time, and we'll have some details on that. Plus, there are warnings from the FBI that, among other things, people who advocate the idea that the United States went bankrupt by going off the gold standard are dangerous extremists and that they can become violent at the drop of a hat. We will be touching on that during the show as well. But the big headline that we're following today is something that actually comes out of a story from a year ago, March 2011, a LIBOR probe that is beginning to bear fruit nearly a year later. Jake, why don't you give us the initial details on that?
Sure. More than a dozen traders and brokers in London, Asia, have been fired, suspended, or put on leave by their employers as a multinational probe into the alleged manipulation of crucial global lending rates accelerates. This is right off of financialtimes.com, FT.com. Regulators have been investigating U.S. and European banks that set the interbank lending rates in London and Tokyo since late 2010. An extensive profile inquiry that spans three continents and involves at least nine separate enforcement agencies. So the big thing here to our listeners who may not be aware of the importance of LIBOR is that this LIBOR interest rate is used as a benchmark for $3.5 trillion worth of financial products, such as mortgages, that are set by a daily poll of a panel of banks in each region. So, you know, kind of one of the recurring themes of our show is how the banks are kind of in control of everything. The banks that included the folks that are setting this rate are charged with manipulating it. Were taken away from Deutsche Bank, J.P. Morgan Chase, the Royal Bank of Scotland, a major U.K. bank, and Citigroup. All four banks have declined to comment.
Yes, this is becoming quite the thing. In fact, it's a story that barely broke last year. We broke it, of course, here on the Freedom News Hour, but most of the media pretty much ignored it. It was not considered a big thing, and it just went underground as the various governments in the world got involved in investigating it. Now it's starting to reemerge, and this time I think it's going to get a little more media attention because there are a couple of really interesting pieces coming out of it. One of them, from another Financial Times article, you cited that one from FT.com, another one is an article that came out just an hour ago called Probe Reveals Scale of LIBOR Abuse. And it's a continuation of the original story from yesterday. In that article, toward the end of the article, let me just read from you. The Royal Bank of Scotland is being sued by a former employee in Singapore who it dismissed last year for allegedly trying to influence LIBOR rates. More explosively, Tan Chi Min, who RBS fired for, quote, gross misconduct, unquote, has claimed in court documents that it was common practice at the bank for clients to submit requests for certain LIBOR rate bids to try and maximize their own profit. RBS, which has also fired or suspended other employees in connection with the investigation, denies Mr. Tan's allegations and is contesting the case in Singapore. Now, why am I pointing that out? Well, as you go through these articles, both at the Financial Times, and there's also articles at Business Week and so on and so forth, you see the same theme over and over again. The banks are trying to cooperate. They're doing everything they can with to cooperate with the authorities. And this claim that this dismissed employee makes basically flies in the face of that, because what he's essentially implying is something that, you know, basic rational logic tells us must be true. The higher-ups knew about this all along. It was common practice. And since it was common practice, the one thing that everybody in the banking community wants to make sure happens is to make it clear that, no, it wasn't common practice at all. This was these were just some obscure employees who kind of went rogue and did it on their own. There was no bank leadership on that. I mean, come on, how are we supposed to believe that, Jake? It's crazy.
Yeah, no, for sure. And I think this is just kind of like a little bit of the tip of the iceberg, kind of like a small glimpse into how this this whole house of cards is held up.
Yes.
Because, again, you know, the banks are controlling what the LIBOR rate is. And the LIBOR rate is a has a major influence, of course, in the economy. And, you know, similar to how the Fed sets its federal funds rate to try and drive the interest rates down. You know, at the end of the day, this is just a delay tactic. Interest rates can't be suppressed near zero forever. Although they're certainly, the Fed at least is making a go of it. We talked about last week, so they've had, I think, 3 years of near zero, and they're talking about another 2.5 more.
Something like that, yeah. And as we look at what's happening with the LIBOR rates, it becomes increasingly clear that not only are the largest banks in the world involved in it, banks like Citigroup, Bank of Scotland, UBS, JP Morgan, Chase, and Deutsche Bank, among others, but also a lot of the largest hedge funds and interdealer brokers are involved. ICAP is one of the leading ones, headed by Michael Spencer. He's a leading fundraiser for the UK's Conservative Party. Is directly involved in the probe. So are Tulip Preben and R.P. Martin. These are three of the largest in the world interdealer brokers involved in this emerging scandal. So first of all, I think it's safe to say this is not something that's going to go away anytime soon. So they've been doing this for, 11 months now? And they're just now starting to come out with brokers being dismissed, brokers being suspended, brokers being given leaves of absence. I mean, when you start hearing that kind of thing, the first thing that comes to my mind is this is just the beginning. This is not the end. This is like the tip of the iceberg.
Yep. And, you know, as we kind of talked about on the show for quite some time, you know, a lot of, not everyone, of course, in the financial sector, but many of them really belong on trial rather than you know, going away with these monster fortunes. And, you know, the other main, I guess, crime, that's in quotation marks because it's completely legal per the legal system, that we talk about again and again on the show, is that you also have to remember that all these people are doing, whether it's MF Global or this deal with the LIBOR or whatever, they are taking deposits away from people and using them. And meanwhile, saying that they can always get, you know, telling the depositors they can get their money back. It's a fraud of types, although the legal system doesn't address it as such. So that's just another icing on the cake as why we shouldn't have this type of banking system, because the people that get in power will abuse it at the expense of everyone.
Absolutely true. Absolutely true. It's also important to note that the probe, this is based on the reports that we received last March, the probe features activity that took place from 2006 to 2009. And, of course, that includes the financial crisis of 2008, so it's obvious to see why they're focusing on that. But the question I raised at the time, and I still think it's a valid question, I haven't seen anything in any of these articles to suggest it's no longer a valid question, is what reason do we have to believe that it ended in 2009? I mean, it's quite clear that it has been a very, very direct and obvious Fed policy and European Central Bank policy and so forth to keep interest rates as low as possible. Well, what better way to do that than by artificially manipulating LIBOR rates down to be at the lowest possible level? I really believe, of course, I have no evidence to prove this. We have very little evidence about what's actually been found so far because the Feds and the Japanese and the UK and so forth, all the government authorities are keeping all that evidence themselves. But nevertheless, you know, the speculation is going to be pretty easy to come up with here. And my speculation is there's no reason to believe that the whole thing stopped in 2009. And it probably goes on to this day, which means, and this is the really critical point, the LIBOR rate, from the perspective of most Americans who don't even understand the banking system, its greatest role of importance is that it plays a direct role in variable rate mortgages. Because it's the LIBOR rate and the changes in the LIBOR rate that lead to increases or decreases in many variable rate percentages that people pay on their mortgages. Well, as long as that's the case, and as long as we're in an economic situation where the Fed have made it their policy to ensure that interest rates stay as low as possible so that the bank losses don't look so bad and so that homeowners get a breath of fresh air so that they don't have to get their homes foreclosed on and so forth, Do I have to draw a line connecting the dots? I mean, this is just such obvious manipulation.
Right, and it's really nasty how all these things work out because, you know, the housing bubble that kind of popped in 2007, 2008, that was, created by the extra credit from the very low interest rates from the Federal Reserve. So you had this whole housing sector kind of a bubble, all these resources being misallocated into construction jobs, and this massive buildup in capital, these homes, and a subsequent crash. And I think that the crash in the housing prices would have been far worse, or the drop would have been much higher if the government didn't step in to prop things up. And manipulating LIBOR rates, of course, is a key part of that, because you don't want people, the banks, I shouldn't say the people, the banks don't want people walking away from their homes when their mortgage goes underwater, because then they're stuck trying to sell it back at a lower price, and they're eventually going to take the loss. And the money, that, you know, the $500,000 or whatever that they lent out for the home is not something that they actually have. They have to give it back to the people that they, have it on deposit. So it's a big cycle that kind of all started with one thing, and it's just kind of snowballing and snowballing and snowballing. And I agree with you, Walt. You know, we haven't seen the last of it, because, you know, what the government and the banking sector has done trying to cushion the fall, I think I think the healthiest thing would have been for it to crash all the way down and then make its way back, and that way you would have worked out all the bubble completely. But, you know, now we're looking at it's 2012 now. We're like 5 years past the bubble pop, and it's still a very tough market. Housing starts are still, like, I think, below, like, the 1965 low, just an absurd low level. So what they're doing is really kind of stretching out the pain. The maximum pain hasn't been as much as it would have been, I think, but the overall pain over time is incredible. But the banks are the ones that profit from this, the banksters.
The banks definitely profit from it. I mean, you noted how the real estate market would have crashed a lot worse than it did if they hadn't intervened. It isn't just the real estate market, of course. It's the entire monetary system that would have crashed, because the entire monetary system is in crisis and has been throughout this entire period, despite all the news that we keep getting from Washington and from the Fed and so on and so forth, telling us about, oh, how things are improving and everything's getting better and the banks are sound again and all that kind of thing. Baloney. It's all baloney. It's all designed to make you retain a confidence level, which is what the entire fiat monetary system is dependent upon. But that fiat monetary system is broken. It's broken beyond repair. And that's the reason they didn't dare let it crash, because if they let it crash, first of all, every major bank in existence gets wiped out. All the minor banks in existence get wiped out. We end up having to redo the monetary system. And as I'm sure you and I would both agree, that would be a good thing, because we wouldn't get wiped out. It would be the wealthy who'd get wiped out. We would have actually a good monetary system to replace it, because you can't just replace it with another fiat monetary system. There's no confidence in a fiat monetary system when the whole thing collapses. That means you have to go to something that's level and steady. And as you and I both know, when you have a level and steady money supply, you get an entirely different economic situation. You get prosperity that lasts. You get prosperity that goes down to the lowest levels of society. You stop increasing the gap between the rich getting richer and the poor getting poorer, and on and on and on and on. There's just so many benefits to it.
You know, we have to remember too that this is also how what I like to call the two-headed one-party system stays in power. Because when the Obama administration came into power in January of 2009, Joe Biden was later videotaped talking about the first challenges that the administration faced. And, there was this massive trillion-dollar stimulus plan that, completely failed to stimulate any jobs, created a few scandals, that solar company that Obama visited, Solyndra. But what Vice President Joe Biden said was that one of the first decisions that they had to decide on was whether or not to declare a bank holiday. And our listeners may not know what happens during a bank holiday. It's not like a day off where everybody goes and relaxes. The banks close and they devalue the currency. And whatever you have in the bank, you may or may not be able to get it out right away, but for sure is when you go to spend it, it'll be worth a lot less. And, of course, they did not have a bank holiday yet. But something tells me that maybe that stimulus plan, which didn't create any jobs, might have gone into backstopping the system.
No. Yeah, I think there's actually a lot of evidence to support what you're saying. I think it's really true. Well, that is not, of course, the only news they have today, but it's the one that yesterday and today, I should say, but it's the one that we're certainly focusing on. It's interesting that at the same time that happens, the U.S. government is preparing to announce that they have come to terms, or not just the U.S. government, but various state governments have announced that they have come to terms with the banking industry to basically slap them on the wrist for the way they handled the robo-signing crisis. Interesting pattern how these things work out, but that's essentially what's happening. Looking at the particular details of the story, I'll take this one from ABC News, entitled Feds Announced $25 Billion Foreclosure Abuse Deal. Government officials announced a record $25 billion settlement with the five biggest banks related to foreclosure abuses, including robo-signing of documents. The deal is the largest multi-state settlement since the tobacco settlement in 1998. The Department of Justice said among the money allocated will be $1.5 billion distributed nationwide to about 750,000 borrowers who lost their homes to foreclosure. But just a side note, I've seen articles citing what the number of borrowers were who are going to be affected by this. It started around 2 million, and in the course of a day and a half, it has shrunk to 750,000. It's just amazing. Attorney General Eric Holder said the deal by 49 state attorneys general, who worked late into the hours of last night, does not preclude states from pursuing their own suits against the banks. The state attorney general of Oklahoma did not sign the settlement. And basically, the whole thing comes down to this. There are roughly one-fifth of all homeowners around the country who are currently underwater. There are millions who have lost their homes, and this bank settlement is going to put money into the hands of a tiny fraction of that group. There is a lot of news coming out about how virtually all the money is going to go to the claimants, to the people who got harmed, but that isn't necessarily holding up when you look at it logically speaking. And it raises a number of questions about what's going to be the government's response to all of the other people who find that they don't actually qualify for these funds. It's going to be really interesting to see, because right now President Obama is trying to shore up his reelection chances. But there's, what, ten months left in the election cycle. Plenty of time for people to realize that they're not going to get covered by this.
Oh, yeah, and, the American public is going to be faced with, whoever comes out of this whole GOP primary mess or Obama, which, who really hasn't delivered on a lot of his promises that he was elected on, to close Guantanamo Bay, for starters, to end the wars. Iraq I almost don't count because we got kicked out by the Iraqis and definitely expanded.
Well, he'll count it. I can count on that.
Yeah, we've expanded the Afghanistan war. The drone attacks are happening all over the world. We bombed Libya without clear violation of the War Powers Act. Obama never did go to Congress for the authorization. Just blatant constitutional violations. And just simple campaign promises like, let's stop the torture and what have you. Really hasn't delivered, and I think that overall, the economy, of course, he hasn't delivered as well, probably his biggest chance of getting, or I would say one of his best assets in getting elected, is the GOP is just offering more or less the same thing under a different label, and their primary is competitive, which may, in fact, with the recent developments with Santorum scoring some victories, may end up having a competitive convention, which I think would be a good thing overall.
Although there's some question about how competitive such a convention would be, because when we look at it, I mean, like you observed earlier, there's really only one party, and there are essentially two wings. There's the liberal wing of the big government party, and there's the conservative wing of the big government party. And the only difference between the two of them is they have different ideas of how they want to spend all the money and use all the power that the big government keeps accumulating as it gets larger and larger and larger. So I'm not sure exactly how good a divided Republican Party convention really is when most of the candidates are so obviously in favor of big government. But I suppose there is the one hope about Ron Paul, and that you know, perhaps he takes a major role and plays a major role in the convention. Maybe that becomes the basis for the conversation. But beyond that, I don't really see it.
Yeah, well, let's also be clear, like, the two parties tell the American people that they want, that they have different spending priorities, but at the end of the day, they pretty much are voting for the exact same things. Like, I would say that the one of the main things in the last election cycle and this election cycle that where the Republicans try to separate themselves is the Obamacare plan, that they're, you know, wholeheartedly against it, and, you know, the Democrats are, you know, for it or whatever. But so you think that, you know, the Republicans are, you know, against federal government intervention in healthcare. But if you go back to the Bush administration, Medicare Part D, when they were in power, they did the exact same thing. They messed around with the whole healthcare system, generated trillions upon trillions of dollars in unfunded liabilities into the future. In effect, they might have also been really hurting the entire Social Security and Medicaid programs are partially quite unstable into the future due to those moves. So, you know, they really, and the Democrats sometimes claim that, you know, they're not for the wars or whatever, but they are. I mean, they vote to approve all the arms spending, all the wars, just the same as the Republicans do.
It's interesting that you're mentioning this, because I had a conversation just this past week with a business associate of mine. He was telling me in a sort of casual conversation that his views are becoming more and more liberal as time goes on. And so I listened to him as he gave me his spiel and so forth. And when he was done, I was saying, you know, there's one thing about the liberals that really bothers me. He says, what's that? I said, they don't acknowledge the role that the monetary and banking system plays in creating the very issues they claim to be opposed to, and yet they are among the biggest backers of the monetary and banking system. In fact, if you had to pick between the liberals and conservatives as to which one would be stronger backers of the monetary and banking system as it's currently structured, it would be a pretty tough coin toss to say which one would be the more fervent backers, because, let's be honest, the liberal program, the entire liberal program, depends on having an expansionary monetary system, which is exactly what we have. Take away the ability of the monetary system to expand itself, which, of course, is what creates the bubbles and everything else we've been talking about, the liberal agenda falls to the ground because there's no way to pay for it. Now, you can say the same thing about the conservative agenda, too, but just in the context of what I was describing to my friend, I said, you know, how can liberals who claim to be in favor of, for instance, fighting the growing gap between the rich getting richer and the poor getting poorer, at the same time take a stance in favor of an expansive monetary system that created the gap in the first place?
Well, and on the same token, how can, you know, quote-unquote conservatives claim to be, you know, fiscally responsible and wanting a balanced budget and reducing the national debt, yada, 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 when at the same time they, you know, do nothing or are completely unaware and act unaware of the over $1 trillion in federal spending that we spend on our really foreign adventures abroad, foreign aid, and what have you. It's really kind of a travesty when you get down to it. But at the end of the day, I think that, you know, the American people kind of buy in a lot to the media stereotypes that are kind of thrown at them. They need to fit either the evangelical gun-toting role, or they need to fit the role that they put the stereotypical Democrat into. But, you know, what it comes down to is that the very words conservative and liberal, what I like to call them is they're just adjectives that can get misused as nouns. Because when you look into what those words actually stand for, conservative meaning to keep everything the same and to guard and protect, and liberal as to, you know, change and move ahead into the future, I think that, you know, we kind of do need to change and move ahead into the future. But the reality is the liberals and the conservatives, at the end of the day, they support parties that back policies that are completely, there's no difference between the two.
That's true. It's
very hard to find any.
And by the way, to finish off that story I was telling about my friend, when I made my claim to him about how the liberals ignore that, his initial gut reaction was the one I always get. Well, what do you want? You want to go back to a gold standard? That didn't work. And I said, isn't that typical. I mean, I'm not particularly in favor of a gold standard either. I want a level steady money supply, but I recognize that the banks were able to get through a gold standard. But every time I raise this question with liberal, what's the knee-jerk reaction I get? Well, what do you want? You want a gold standard? And that, for them, ends the discussion. No, it doesn't end the discussion. Just because a gold standard didn't work, just because a gold standard wasn't the final solution, doesn't mean we should stop talking about the fact that the liberals and the conservatives still believe in an expansion money supply, and that that same money supply situation is what's causing the problems that we have in the first place. That shouldn't end the discussion. And when I said that to him, he didn't have anything to say. It was really quite remarkable.
Well, that and even the classical gold standard that, you know, everyone that uses the phrase is pretty much referring to, like back, before World War I drove all the European countries and eventually the U.S. off this gold standard. Even under the classical gold standard, the bankers still expanded, but there was just the only difference really was there was a little bit of discipline in the there was a little bit of a break on the money creation. You couldn't really go at it completely willy-nilly, but they could go about it, and for sure they did quite a bit. So, yeah, you're completely right. The main thing needs, folks need a little bit of an education. The second thing is, you know, to have that discussion.
Absolutely. And in fact, I also want to point out why it is that the gold standard did fail. The reason it failed was because, let's be honest, the government didn't enforce the law. The law basically said you had to always be able to provide X amount of gold for Y amount of dollars. And if you couldn't do that, you were in violation of the law. Of course, the interesting part was there were no penalties for violating that law. I think it's one of the most stunning things when you read the history. There was no penalty for not doing that. It was just simply the government promises to do that, so we'll do that. Well, when push came to shove, and the 1920s, the roaring 20s, the monetary expansion in the form of bank deposits skyrocketed, leading to a huge market bubble, followed by a crash in 1929, and then a depression leading into the 1930s. What did we end up with in 1932? The thing you talked about earlier, a bank holiday, where they closed the banks, and what did they do in conjunction with that? They seized all the gold because they couldn't honor all of the demands for gold that would be made by the people holding the paper money, and they knew it. And that's why FDR took the gold. So right. The government basically just defaulted on their responsibility. That's why you can't trust the gold standard, because the gold standard depends on the very same institution, the government, to make sure that it gets carried out. And this is the same institution which has a vested interest in expanding the money supply.
Exactly. And I think some of the malaise today in understanding what's going on, even after over the last few years where you start to see buy gold, buy silver signs everywhere, is that, we haven't gone through kind of like the downward swing of the spiral yet. Because, when the country was first started and, the phrase worth less than a continental, which came from George Washington printing up all this money to pay the soldiers, which, wasn't backed by anything, and that currency's collapse following the revolution. The Constitution, which maybe we'll talk about in the second part of the show for a little bit, was created really just to have money coined by the government, and really that was it, to coin a uniform gold and silver coins. And then when they created the U.S. Mint, when they evaluated counterfeit penalties, it was very clear what the penalty was. It was death. And I think that, these things kind of move in cycles. So the people back then were very much aware of the evils of paper money and how it can be abused and hurt everyone. And we're kind of, really kind of since then, more or less, you've seen, the dollar devalued quite a bit, especially over the last 100 years. And I think that after the crash, you're going to have that same type of attitude. The cycle may, in fact, repeat again, but hopefully it'll take another 100 years.
I guess the one thing we can hold out hope for is that through our show and through other efforts of people around the country and even around the world to try to educate the public, maybe enough people will be informed this time around that when the push does come to shove, people will finally realize just how badly they're being taken advantage of by everyone, from the financial sector, the government, so on and so forth, and say, enough is enough. We're going to stop this. And we're going to take a quick break. After the break, we're going to pick up on a story that kind of plays off of this, because it turns out, Jake, I don't know if you knew this, but you and I are potential terrorists. We're going to touch on that after the break. This is the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown, here on the Progressive Radio Network. We will be right back. Yep, run back to your dial. We're back here on the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. And as I rather genteelly alluded to before the break, the FBI, this is from a Reuters article, Dateline, Monday, February 6th, Washington, D.C., by Patrick Temple West. FBI warns of threat from anti-government extremists. Anti-government extremists opposed to taxes and regulations pose a growing threat to local law enforcement officers in the United States, the FBI warned on Monday. These extremists, sometimes known as sovereign citizens, believe they can live outside any type of government authority, FBI agents said at a news conference. The extremists may refuse to pay taxes, defy government environmental regulations, and believe the United States went bankrupt by going off the gold standard. Routine encounters with police can turn violent at the drop of a hat, said Stuart MacArthur, Deputy Assistant Director in the FBI's Counterterrorism Division. We thought it was important to increase the visibility of the threat with state and local law enforcement, he said. In May 2010, two West Memphis, Arkansas police officers were shot and killed in an argument that developed after they pulled over a sovereign citizen in traffic. Last year, an extremist in Texas opened fire on a police officer during a traffic stop. The officer was not hit. Legal convictions of such extremists, mostly for white-collar crimes such as fraud, have increased from 10 in 2009 to 18 each in 2010 and 2011, FBI agents said. We are being inundated right now with requests for training from state and local law enforcement on sovereign-related matters, said Casey Carty, an FBI supervisory special agent. FBI agents said they do not have a tally of people who consider themselves sovereign citizens. J.J. McNabb, a former tax and insurance expert who is an analyst covering the sovereign movement, has estimated that it has about 100,000 members. Sovereign members often express particular outrage at tax collection, putting Internal Revenue Service employees at risk. You hear that, Jake?
Wow, you're people extreme. Don't like the IRS.
I mean, what a statement to be made. All you have to do is say that you're opposed to what the government is doing, that you're opposed to what the banking community is doing, that you think that regulations are out of control, and according to the FBI, you are a dangerous extremist who could go off at any moment and become violent. What a thing to say. Unbelievable. Absolutely unbelievable. I read that, and I have to tell you, Jake, I almost fell out of my chair.
I don't doubt it.
I mean, what is this country coming to? When it gets to the point, I mean, let's put it this way. How is this different from what the fascists were doing in the 1930s? How is this different?
Not by a whole kit and caboodle. I mean, you know, a lot of these things that the evils that people associate with that back then, you know, such as the Holocaust and the concentration camps and what have you, a lot of that eventually did come later. But the first thing that any of these governments need to do is, for whatever reason, take away people's freedoms. And when that occurs, you become more and more exposed to what the government wants to do to you.
And that's exactly right. I mean, listen to the numbers they presented in this. Legal convictions of such extremists, mostly for white-collar crimes such as fraud, have increased from 10 in 2009 to 18 each in 2010 and 2011. This is the big threat.
Right, and like we talked about last week, this new bureaucracy and part of Homeland Security, forget even the name of it, it was like the Terrorist Support Center or something like that, they increased the no-fly list from 10,000 to 20,000. And I think that just highlights, you know, once these bureaucracies kind of get going with impeding civil rights, they continue to do so because their own power and influence and pay is based on that. And of course, you know, who's paying the people that are working in government? Well, you know, it's coming from us. So, and the whole thing is, I think that really, in a lot of ways, the governments that we have these days are really illegitimate. I think that the vast majority of the American people, which the mainstream media doesn't really kind of get into a whole lot, except when they do congressional approval surveys that come in, you know, 10% or what have you, that you know, the people really are very fed up with the system of government that they have, because you know, bottom line is it's not getting results, it's not getting prosperity, and people are very slowly at times, but figuring out that, hey, you know, this isn't so good, and you know, all over the world, that's kind of going on at different rates and different stories. You know, Egypt, Libya, Syria now these days, there's a lot of unrest. A lot of it is related, unfortunately, to, you know, this economic changes and economic use of money by the banksters.
Absolutely true. And it's such a sad thing to see not only what's happening in those countries, but what's happening here. Obviously, this is a direct statement of threat to our national, our individual liberties here in this nation. And it basically points to just how badly the Constitution's been shredded, how few of our rights are left. I mean, just even the last decade, all the different ways that the government has gone out of its way to carve away more and more of what was left of the rights that are protected by the Constitution. And in fact, I think you found something that showed just how deeply those cuts in the constitutional protections have gone over the last few years.
Oh, yeah, and I guess first I'll quickly touch on a local news story here in eastern Pennsylvania. It made headlines. A 25-year-old woman was found, actually she was found not guilty. She asked for a trial by jury, which is her constitutional right. She was given a trial. She was acquitted by the jury of drunk driving. You know, the details I don't think are super important, but she was acquitted by the jury, and then the judge didn't like what the jury said, so he went ahead and convicted her and is trying to send her to jail time and fine and loss of license all at the same time. And people here are reacting, you know, what's up with this? You're innocent until proven guilty or what have you, but you know, this judicial system has really gone bonkers. Like, the rule of law is absent in this country, and to a large extent, that's what our commerce and trade and prosperity has been built upon on, you know, the past history of the nation. I think there was an article that just came out a couple days ago on in the New York Times, that bastion of mainstream media.
And, very, very tactfully stated.
And the headline is, "We the People," meaning the Constitution, "loses appeal with people around the world." This reporter goes on to say, you know, the Constitution has seen better days and it's in decline because its influence is waning, and such a, you know, bad document, and modern constitutions are not following it. And, you know, what's interesting is, you know, he's saying that it loses appeal with people around the world. He's not asking the person on the street. He goes in, everyone in the article is these high gurus or political gurus. But he does go into talking to some people in a certain part of the article that I thought was particularly enlightening. He interviewed Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg of the United States Supreme Court, and she said, quote, "I would not look to the United States Constitution if I were drafting a constitution in the year 2012, unquote. Instead, she recommended the South African Constitution or the EU Constitution instead. And what's interesting, so I was kind of curious, you know, what's so great about this South African Constitution? And I read through it, and, you know, everyone knows about the apartheid that went on there, and, you know, things were not so good in that country and everything. But their constitution itself is very much modeled after the USSR constitution.
Oh, God.
And also the constitution of communist China. And in that and people can read it. It's actually a pretty interesting document. It goes through, it guarantees, certain things that other people just would pay for, such as it guarantees a state education, it guarantees state health care. And, some people might say these are very good things to have, but unfortunately, just because you legislate it doesn't mean it can happen. And there's some very key differences between the two things. For instance, the United States, we'll go on to one more Supreme Court justice quote. This is from Justice Antonin Scalia. He said, quote, this is hilarious, "The Bill of Rights of the formal evil empire, the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, was much better than ours." Then he then added, quote, "We guarantee freedom of speech and the press, a big deal. They guaranteed freedom of speech of the press, street demonstrations of protest, and anyone who's caught trying to suppress criticism of the government will be called to account." And he said, "This is wonderful stuff." And, obviously, there's certain parts of that, like obviously people that criticize the government should be allowed to say whatever they want. That's freedom of speech. But, these guys are actually saying that the USSR Constitution is better, and they're the ones that are supposed to be interpreting the U.S. Constitution. And, again, just back to the South African one, I was like, well, what about the, freedom to bear arms? The United States Constitution has that pretty well enshrined. And the only under the South African Constitution, you're not entitled, it's not even mentioned in it. The only time that arms is mentioned is when it says that everyone, under freedom of assembly, it says everyone has the right peacefully and unarmed to assemble, to demonstrate, to picket, and to present petitions. So in South Africa, you can protest the government, but you better not show up to it with a weapon. Otherwise, all of a sudden, you are, criminally can be removed. And remember, for those that might say, well, critics of the, this type of thing, guess who has all the guns? The government does. It's not fair for, one side to have all the guns and the other not. So this Constitution is very much set up to enshrine a statist government, meaning that government has to really provide everything to everyone. Housing, the South African Constitution, everyone has the right to have access to adequate housing. Same thing with the USSR, same thing with Communist China. We'll define adequate housing. I would want to live in a really nice place, have all my bills paid for and everything like that. But just because someone writes it down doesn't mean that, it doesn't mean that you can have it. And another thing on due process, like we just talked about here in Pennsylvania, where the judge overturned, this result of the trial by jury. Well, in South Africa, you don't even have a right to trial by jury. So the government gets to interpret its own laws and decide against you. It's, again, the Supreme Court trying to look towards South Africa or the USSR as what they want our constitution to be is really just a giant travesty. And I think the one quote where Justice Antonin Scalia did kind of get this all right. Justice Antonin Scalia said, quote, "Of course, it's just words on paper, what our framers would have called a parchment guarantee," unquote. And I don't think the founders really meant it to be a parchment guarantee, but he and the rest of the Supreme Court and the rest of Congress and the president, they certainly just treat it like it's a piece of parchment.
Yeah, that's pretty much true. And in fact, it's also interesting to note that the two justices that were quoted in the article who you sort of did pull quotes on, Justice Scalia and Justice Ginsburg. Justice Scalia is generally considered to be the most conservative member of the court. Justice Ginsburg is considered to be one of the most liberal members of the court. And both of them, talking about what we talked about earlier, about the two two branches of the same party, both of them arguing that the protections of the U.S. Constitution are inferior to so-called protections of the USSR. I mean, that's just frightening. But it shows and illustrates very clearly that both the liberal and conservative wings of the big government party are totally in favor of big government, totally in favor of basically undermining and destroying the rights of the people. And, oh, by the way, wasn't there something in the U.S. Constitution about a right to a trial by jury? Well, apparently not in Pennsylvania. Oh, God.
Yeah, no, the local folks are kind of up in arms, but this judge who was put in there, he even says that this person happened to have a past history with a judge. So maybe, who knows, that this judge had it out for this person. But it's just, again, the judge isn't really supposed to be the one, the whole judge, jury, and executioner rolled up in one. It's supposed to provide the forum, really, for the jury to decide if a crime has been committed. So,
do you have any information as to whether or not the person who was convicted by the judge is planning to appeal?
Oh, yeah, they are certainly planning to appeal.
So we're actually going to get to, at least the chance of finding out whether or not the appellate system and perhaps even the Supreme Court are going to agree with this judge that he has the right to overrule a trial by jury when the trial by jury comes to a conclusion that's different from his own.
Yeah, we'll see. I mean, I think most people would say, well, certainly it'll be overturned, but people tend to forget who actually owns the system, and the quote-unquote law is really just an arm of the what I like to call the Republicrat Party.
Yes.
That's where those judges come from.
And, of course, so, Republicrat is another name for big government.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, there are many possible names for our all-favorite, huge, massive two-wing party. But we won't go into them all right now. Instead, what we're going to do is go overseas and see what's happening over in Europe. But first, before we get to Europe, we're going to go a little bit south. And, Jake, would you give us a little update on what's happening in Iran? Because we've already touched in the past few weeks about how their economy is going into double-digit inflation and the monetary system is about to fall apart. But that has taken itself to a new phase.
Yes. Well, President Obama, again, Iran has been under U.S. economic sanctions since the Clinton administration, and we're pretty much getting to the point where we're even cutting off food and water. And people that have passed these, they would say, "Oh no, humanitarian aid is unaffected." But the actual wording of the agreement doesn't specifically ban food or water shipments, but it makes it impossible to pay with it with the international payment system, which, of course, is kind of dollar-based. So, in effect, it is a complete embargo on this country, which has not harmed anyone. President Obama has taken, a lesson from Republican President George Bush with executive orders, and he has reemphasized has worked to seize all assets of the Iranian Central Bank in the U.S., which I guess is not really particularly new news, this is just another step towards warfare. Because again, economic warfare is just the same as actual conventional warfare. And Iran, separate articles on Reuters, Iran is turning to its neighbors such as India and China for food supplies, since they can't really get grain off the international market. The rumors, traders are reporting that Iran is using golden oil as payment for massive shipments of soft wheat around the world. So, you have starvation going on. The government of Iran, which, just to be clear, I don't like at all. I think they're just kind of like the rest of the governments, very totalitarian.
Probably even more so in their case.
yeah. But, it's trying to secure, the traders are trying to secure food, and they're having to waste their gold at what are probably pretty undervalued prices in order to obtain it. So it's just kind of a sad thing to see as, the European sanctions Europe is finally following the lead of Israel and the United States and applying sanctions to the country. And like I said before, I think this is just going to turn Iran more and more away from the West, so to speak, and for support from India, Pakistan, and Russia and China. They really don't have any other doubt because, or they don't really have any other recourse since this economic embargo is really going to start hitting the Iranian people pretty soon.
It's already hitting them. That's the point. And what's even worse is nobody seems to be asking what I think is the most important question of all. How is this going to help? I mean, we already know that the West has a tremendous problem with the Eastern Muslim nations. How does this not lead to even more problems? Because if this does get to the point where it becomes something on the order of a human catastrophe, which apparently Iran is very close to, well, at what point do the rest of the Muslims start identifying with their fellow Muslim Brotherhood in Iran and say, well, hey, the West is killing our people. They're taking out on the people of Iran their disagreement with the Iranian government. And they're ending up starving people to death, driving them into abject poverty. I mean, how can this turn out good for the West? I don't see it.
Well, it happened the same in Iraq, over Saddam Hussein's regime. Pretty much happened, which, culminated in the carpet bombing of the country by the U.S. Military forces in Gulf War I and II, which was also, of course, attended by an economic embargo. And I think that's really what Iran is kind of being faced with. And, this is not the way, this is not diplomacy in any way or shape or form. As a matter of fact, you could even really call it gunboat diplomacy because, yeah, we are applying the economic pressure. But, militarily, we are present in the Persian Gulf, and Iran is very much aware of this. And, this is supposedly all being done to prevent Iran from getting nuclear weapons, but there still is no evidence that they had proceeded towards that. And at this point, with these embargo being placed, and I think we talked about it in past weeks, but, the currency got destroyed by over 50%. Against the dollar, and what we also talked about last week is the courts of Iran are threatened to behead people if they use the dollar, the death penalty, complete economic chaos. Who could blame, I hope that nuclear arms don't proliferate, but who could blame Iran from trying to get nuclear weapons? Because if they did somehow get nuclear weapons, then they could defend themselves.
Right, exactly.
And then the reason from the embargo would be moot.
It would be completely moot, and now we'd be in a whole new world, really bad one to boot on top of all that.
Yeah, there's tremendous instability in the region. Syria is really turning into a giant bloodbath under the Assad regime, which is another U.S.-backed regime. We've seen this, acting out over the past the year. The European military is still in charge of Egypt. Who paid for the European military? The United States of America. The Egyptian people who were trying to kick out the dictator, but instead they just got a military dictatorship. Libya. Who knows what the heck's going on in that country? And there's a lot more unrest all over the world, and it continues to accelerate, which is, not very good news for world peace and prosperity and trade.
Absolutely true. And meanwhile, a few miles north of there in the Eurozone, the problems there continue to worsen and worsen. The media still haven't quite caught on to it lately. They lost track of it last October. But word came out today that the Greek parties came together. They did grudgingly, in a unified way, display their support for the terms of the bailout. And then hours after Greece made that very unpopular decision against what their entire population is in favor of, the German finance minister came out and questioned whether the deal goes far enough to earn the crucial $130 billion
130 billion euro bailout that was promised in exchange for these things. Greece's new austerity plan, this is from an article at USA Today, Greece's new austerity plan would make deep cuts in wages and public sector jobs, and it ignited fresh criticism from unions and the country's deputy labor minister. But finance ministers from the other 16 countries that used the euro at a meeting in Brussels to scrutinize the deal indicated that even these painful steps may not be enough to get Greece's economy back on track. Now, this is in the face of the fact that Greece is under imminent pressure to reach a rescue deal conclusion by March 20th, because if they don't reach it by then, the Greek economy, the Greek government could be in default. And when that happens, hold on to your hats, folks, because we'll be in a brand new ballgame. Well, unfortunately, Jake, we're kind of near the end of the show. I wanted to talk about that one more, but we just don't have enough time left, so I guess we'll have to draw a line there. But as usual, it's been a pleasure.
Oh, yeah.
And we will see you all next week here on the Freedom News Hour Surviving Meltdown. Goodbye, everybody.
Stay free.